Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly. Glad everybody could join us. I'm here with my co-host, friend, and colleague, Grant. Welcome, Grant.
Hey, happy Friday night, Doug, and welcome, everybody.
And we have tonight a very special guest with us, Dr. William Roll, and also one of our own spirit team members who studied under Dr. Roll, Kevin. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi there.
And as I talk about Dr. Roll, let me read the bio. We had a couple of startup thing issues, but we're on, and we're glad everybody was able to join us. William G. Roll, Ph.D., is an Oxford-educated parapsychologist who is famous for his investigations of poltergeist activity and his explanation of recurring spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK, for which he coined the term. He has appeared on numerous segments of Unsolved Mysteries, as well as the Discovery Channel and other television documentaries. Dr. Roll joined the staff of the Parapsychology Laboratory, Duke University, in the late 50s, working under Dr. J.B. Rhine until 1964. During this time, he made his first RSPK and haunt investigations, was appointed project director of the Psychical Research Foundation, and elected president of the Parapsychological Association. In 1986, Dr. Roll was appointed professor of psychical research and psychology at West Georgia College, now the State University of West Georgia, where he continued to write and teach until his retirement. In 96, he received the Parapsychological Association's Award for Distinguished Career in Parapsychology. 2002, he was awarded the Dinsdale Memorial Award by the Society for Scientific Investigation for his RSPK studies. Over the course of his extensive career, he has written more than 200 scientific articles and 4 books. We at Paranexus Universe are honored to have Dr. Roll with us. Welcome, Dr. Roll.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, so nice for you to take the time and to be with us tonight. You know what I'm going to do, Grant? Do you have a quick question to start off with while I do a couple of things here?
Sure. Well, Dr. Roll, I couldn't, I'm just as happy as Doug to have you here. It's a real pleasure and an honor, sir. And perhaps you could start off by telling us, or enlightening our audience as to how you originally became interested in the field of parapsychology. I know that, if I remember correctly, your undergraduate work was in sociology, was it not, Doctor?
Well, it actually began when I was in my teens, and I had so-called out-of-body experiences. I didn't know what it was all about, and I asked a neighbor of mine who reviewed. I was living in Denmark. I'm originally Danish, and this man reviewed parapsychological books for the Danish newspapers, and he said, "Well, this is." I read these books and I saw that this was a fairly common experience. So anyhow, that's basically what got me into the field. And there were other things I read about, books about Eastern philosophy and spirituality, and that also, these things also interest me very much. So. Mm-hmm. I went to Berkeley to study out of body to the University of California at Berkeley to study out of body experiences, but the people there were only interested in white rats, and the question did arise whether they might have out of body experiences. So then I heard about. A philosophy professor at Oxford, A.J. Price, and I was able to go and study for him for a year. That extended to 8 years, and I wrote a thesis for which I was awarded the MLit degree. And then later on, I got a PhD at the University of Lund in Sweden. So that's sort of a nutshell shift. Mm-hmm. A picture of my book doing some parapsychology.
Well, parapsychology was still, I mean, I know that the Rhine Institute was originally formed, if I believe correctly, in the 1930s, so it was still relatively a new pioneering sort of area of research, was it not, Doctor? But at the time that you...
I think it still very much is. Mm-hmm. And we're still struggling to find out how to basically the big issue in parapsychology is how can two things be correlated or connected, like two minds or minds with an object, with a remote object or a remote person. How can that happen when there's nothing between the two? There's no information transfer that is known to science, and so that's a big issue, and now it turns out that in fact there is a science what is this where you can have things correlated or connected across space and time with nothing at all between them, and this of course is known as quantum physics, more particularly quantum entanglement, where things that once have been in contact remain in contact afterwards, regardless of how far the two things are in space and time. So to my mind and a few colleagues, this new branch of physics holds the best hope for coming to an understanding of so-called psychic occurrences.
Now, Doctor, when you first got involved with the Rhine Institute, would you say that parapsychology, I think there's a perception out there that parapsychology was more focused towards trying to validate the existence of telepathy. Would that be correct?
Well, it turns out it is impossible to distinguish telepathy from clairvoyance in an experiment, because in a telepathy experiment, there has to be a record, a physical record of the guesses or the impressions by the percipient. And this means that it is possible for clairvoyance, for you to perceive that by clairvoyance, sidestepping telepathy altogether. So although, telepathy was the sort of original thought in it was originally thought that was a basic psychic phenomenon. It turns out that that is not the case. That everything can be described in terms of inspection of physical objects, physical events, and that's clairvoyance.
In those days when you first came to the Ryan Institute, how were your colleagues receptive to looking at different things? Like, you were interested in poltergeist phenomena. Was there an atmosphere of willingness to at least take a look at that?
Well, I wasn't interested in poltergeist occurrences at all. I was only interested in experimental research. When I was at Oxford, all my work was running experiments in ESP and PK, particularly in my ESP experiments. This was all with ESP cards and then using personality tests to see if I could distinguish between people who did well and did poorly in ESP. And I came to Duke to continue the same kind of work. And it wasn't going very well. I wasn't able to get the same results I got at Oxford. And then at one point, Dr. Ryan, who was head of the laboratory, was contacted by a detective in Seaford, Long Island. And this detective had been involved in an investigation of a so-called poltergeist phenomenon. And Ryan asked his assistant director and me to go and look into this case. And it was really through Ryan that I began this work. And my first book, The Poltergeist, that came out in 1972, he wrote the introduction to that. So it was really his doing that I got into this type of work.
I see. That's fascinating. Is that the case when, if I recall, the detective's name was Detective Tozzi, and there was a young boy involved, and you were looking at objects, and the detective was initially skeptical of the whole process?
That's exactly right. Yes.
And could you kind of elaborate, let our audience kind of give them a brief synopsis of that case?
Well, the family consists of two members, parents and two kids, of which the younger one was Jimmy or James, and the occurrences centered around him, and the police had been present when things happened. We were in the house during one of the occurrences that no one apparently could have done normally. So we thought the occurrences were probably parapsychological, and then we arranged for the boy to take psychological tests, Rorschach, TAT, intelligence tests, and so on, to see if he could understand if there was any reason, if there was some sort of subconscious motive for basically the things that broke in the house, or the things that were disturbed were his parents' belongings. And as it turned out, the boy was not at all happy that there was a great deal of tension, particularly between him and the father. The father was extremely strict, and so this was apparently a response by the boy to this intolerable situation, and that took the unusual expression of these. Case of RSPK, movements of optics in his presence. And then there have been other cases over the years. I aside from this book in 1972, which was incidentally reprinted in 2004, that was called The Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. There was a case in another case involving a girl, Tina Resch, R-E-S-C-H, that I investigated, and that I went from her house where I saw several things happening, brought her to a laboratory in North Carolina, where the things continued happening under good conditions, and we looked at her at her brain, particularly her brain stem, to see if we could, the brain stem is where that, where traffic goes up and down between the brain and the environment, to see if we could get anything there to throw light on these phenomena. And indeed, there was an obstacle in the brain stem that I predicted previously predicted. So we thought it was like, and the neurologist who examined the girl thought that this obstacle caused neural energy from her brain to go out into the environment. Now the question is how can, there's no known energy from the body or from the brain that can cause objects to move. But again, if we take a recourse to quantum mechanics, we find that an object is, the location of an object is determined according to this branch of physics, is determined by four quantum numbers. And if you change one of these quantum numbers, the object becomes unstable in the position it is in, and immediately moves, that's theory, immediately moves to another position where, again, it is in a stable position. So again, we have we were confronted with a situation that didn't make sense, couldn't understand what was happening.
Now, you're referring to Tina, is it Reich's case?
R-E-S-C-H.
R-E-S-C-H.
Yes. Now, Doctor, I'm familiar with some of the circumstances in that case. And one of the things I found most fascinating, I found all of it fascinating, but when you brought her into the laboratory and you and your colleagues, I can't remember the other, your associate's name at the moment, but you had placed several heavy objects and you had her completely avoid the area, and one of the objects moved 18 feet, I believe. I believe it was a socket wrench. Now, did you actually see that object move, or how did that all occur, Doctor?
Well, this occurred in the presence of two colleagues, Dr. Bauman, who's a neuroscientist I spoke about, and Mrs. Lagel, who's a psychotherapist and who worked with Tina both as an observer and as a therapist. And they were present when that particular event happened.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, Dr. Roll, this is Doug Kelly. And we've got Kevin Costa on the line as well. He's kind of joining in with us tonight as kind of a co-host as well. Kevin, didn't want to leave you out. Still with us?
Okay. Oh, definitely. I'm listening with interest.
Yeah, it's a great thing. Now, Kevin, can you tell us about...
Let me just say something.
Sure, please.
Yesterday, there's a psychic I've been working with very closely over the years. His name is Sean Haribans, and I brought him up to a laboratory in Canada, a laboratory of a neuropsychologist named Michael Persinger. And anyhow, we did an exhaustive study with Mr. Haribans, and we also did some studies with him back at Duke in the 1960s and 70s. Anyhow, aside from participating in experiments, and he showed amazing evidence that control tests were used cards, and most interesting tests were experiments where we ran these card tests concurrently with EEG readings of his brain. And we found that that his ESP only worked when his brain showed the so-called alpha wave. Anyhow, he made some really bizarre predictions, and he published a book in 1994 where he, for instance, where he said, made the bizarre statement that men will have babies. We are all kind of embarrassed about that, and what a crazy idea it was.
Yeah.
And now it turns out that a man is pregnant. He's on the he's going to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and he's being featured in People magazine. Sean had a vision of a man who was pregnant, and so he made that statement. And there's some other things he said also. At that time, Al Gore was known as the ozone man and was kind of thought to be a little off the rocker. And now, he's got a Nobel Prize for his environmental work. And he's been completely validated and stuff like that. And then Sean comes from Trinidad, and they have oil in Trinidad, not much, but some. So there's a lot of interest in oil as far as Sean is concerned. And at that time, in 1994, the price per barrel hovered around $20. Well, he again made the outrageous statement that it would increase to $100 a barrel, and as we've seen in recent, and he said that would be because of war. He said between the years of 2000 and 2010, it would be at least $100 a barrel. Well, this happened well before then, and hopefully there's not going to be another war, but who knows. We have our eyes on Iran, unfortunately. Anyhow, be that as it may, Sean has, aside from participating in experiments and showing under experiment conditions that he really has it, also made these, at the time, very odd predictions. Of course, of which the oddest is one about a pregnant man, and that turned out to be true,
So, Dr. Roll, how do you explain that from a parapsychological point of view?
Precognition.
Well, that's what it's called. But of course, that's just a word. I think I figured out how it works. It's an appeal to quantum mechanics or quantum theory. This may be too much of a mouthful for you.
Listener. No, keep going. We've got some educated listeners.
I hope they're not more educated than I. Well, that's.
Oh no! Never.
All right.
You have nothing to fear, Doctor.
Yeah, now I'm just sucking up. Okay.
Dr. Rule, could this have something to do with, I've read some of your research, and could it deal with something about, there's something Doug and Grant called the ZPE. It's kind of like the sea of random electromagnetic fluctuations.
Yeah. Well, that was our initial theory. Of course, the problem with precognition is that there seems to be an inspection of a future that does not exist. I mean, the future doesn't exist. That's why we call it the future. And since the future doesn't exist, it can't be perceived. So is there a way around that? Well, the way around it is that the future is filled with possibilities. And what seems to happen is that a person, it would be anybody or a psychic, and lots of people are precognitions, and that a person perceives one of these possibilities because the situation is of interest to him or her, for some sort of psychological reason, we suppose. And that perception, the precognition itself, is what brings the future about. That's what makes the thing happen. Again, it sounds really odd, but it's something that follows from a basic experiment in quantum physics, where things become where things become real by being perceived. So again, it's not easy to convey that in 2 minutes.
Well, that goes back to belief, doesn't it? I mean, they're real because they're...
No, not really. Because according to quantum physics, that's the way the world works. You can't pick and choose in quantum physics and say, well, this is true, this is not true, because it all hangs together. Here's a basic experiment that you have that you divide a subatomic particle, and when you divide it, it has two opposing spins, say called A and B, and you send one half to one observation station where somebody sits by a detector screen, and then the other one goes to a second detector in a second experimenter. Well, when the first experimenter, let's say, sees A, spin A on his machine, the other experimenter of necessity will see B, because it's the same particle. But the particle only manifests when the second experimenter sees the second part of this particle.
Which suggests interactivity between two.
No, it doesn't. According to quantum physics, is that entangled particles remain connected over space and time. There's no signal between them. They are just, they actually are one particle, though they are divided in space and time. So it goes counter to common sense, you know, and that's what makes it hard for us to comprehend. But parapsychology also goes against common sense, and as far as I'm concerned, quantum physics is the only way that makes sense of it, and that connects all psychic occurrences, and moreover connects them with physics and thereby with the rest of science.
Okay, so let's see if we can put this in lay terms, so to speak. All right, so in a nutshell, or what's the connection between parapsychology and quantum mechanics, just to reiterate, just to sum up?
Well, parapsychology, the big problem in parapsychology has been to explain how things that are distant from each other in space and time, two persons or a person in some scene, like in remote viewing where a subject perceives a remote scenery, since there's no transmission from the scenery to the person, and since there's no transmission between the two individuals in a telepathy experiment that we can detect, then we are stylized. And regardless of how much evidence we collect, we are not a science because we don't have a theory for the stuff. And that has been a big problem in parapsychology. Well, now there is a theory, and as it happens, a theory is a physical theory, so that instantaneously connects the field with all other fields, because all fields are basically related to physics. There's something else that's interesting about this entanglement idea, and that is that everything, you know, beginning with the Big Bang onward, you know, everything, you and me, the sun, the moon, everything, was crowded together in this minuscule particle that then sort of exploded and became the universe, you and me, dogs and cats, the moon, the sun, A, B, C, D, and E.
Mm-hmm.
But because we were all entangled, we remain entangled, so we remain connected with each other. So aside from everything else, quantum physics, if one is interested in that perspective, quantum physics provides a basis for spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that we have been looking for, right? I mean, one of the big problems with the paranormal, parapsychology, is that we haven't had the science to explain it, which is what you're saying. But now we have some possibilities to explain it, which is a breakthrough.
Yeah. For me, it's very exciting. And, I mean, this field is quite new to me, quantum physics. I sort of have to figure out how psychic occurrences can be accounted for in this way. And so that's what is sort of preoccupying myself for, you know, for the last few months. And writing a paper for, we're giving a symposium at the American Psychological Association, and so this is going to be presented there in Boston in August this year.
That's great.
And then you know, we'll all present it other places.
That'd be great. We'd love to publish it as well if you send it to us.
Okay.
That'd be excellent. Hey, let me just say a quick word to our listeners. We really appreciate you joining in. We have our very special guest, Dr. Roll. We have Grant with us, of course, as always. And we also have Kevin Costa, who is a Spirit Team member and knows Dr. Roll from previous years. Kevin, thanks for being here, too.
No problem.
Kevin, can you tell us your connection with Dr. Roll, how you met?
Well, actually, I attended West Georgia College, now the University of West Georgia, and there I met Dr. Roll when he was teaching parapsychology to undergraduates. I was getting my master's in humanistic psychology and minoring in parapsychology, and that's where we met through a colleague of his who happened to be the department chairman at that time. Mike Ahrens, and my advisor, who was Don Rice. And through the two of them, I met Bill, and we kind of got interested and we kind of connected when it came to some of his theories and his ideas. And that's why I even say that, you know, to a degree, I've kind of copied Bill's ideas, his philosophy of poltergeist activity, and I'm really flabbergasted in hearing about his quantum theory, because that is something I've even investigated, quantum physics and the connectedness, which kind of, that's one question I wanted to ask.
Can you hold just that question just for a quick second, and I'll let you ask it? I just wanted to tell our listeners as well that you can call in and ask Dr. Roll a question if you wish. The number is there on your screen, 347-945-7799, or you can ask the question in the chat room if you'd like to join us in there if you're not already. And with that having been said, Kevin, go for it.
Okay. The one question, Dr. Roll, I have is when you were talking about the connectiveness of all life and everything and in the explanation of quantum physics in relationship to parapsychology or psychic activity, That kind of explains quite a bit when it came to, I know that you and I were talking on the phone, I believe it was a couple days ago or last week, we were talking about psychometrizing, and you were kind of excited about that idea, that that and that would explain psychometrizing, picking up feelings and ideas and impressions, almost like fingerprints that have been left behind. If we're all connected, somebody sensitive enough could actually pick that up.
Yeah.
And maybe quantum physics doesn't explain that.
Well, we are entangled with stuff around us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this old idea, and now turns out to be superstitious, is that that mind and matter are different. Well, they're certainly different, but it turns out that they are entangled, and entanglement always consists of things that are different. For instance, in this basic experiment, it's a pair of particles with opposite spin that are entangled or that are correlated. The mind and the body are different. When I remember things or feel things, it's not the same as things happening in my hippocampus or my amygdala and so on. But obviously the two are correlated. They are entangled. So we find this entanglement, this quantum entanglement, all over the place. In psychology, everywhere. And particularly, of course, it's valuable in parapsychology, because we couldn't figure out how things were connected at a distance. Well, now we have a model that makes good sense. And now, of course, physicists are dealing with inanimate objects, we're dealing with living objects, we're dealing with biology. So it's a matter of connecting quantum mechanics, I don't particularly like the word mechanics, but anyhow, quantum theory, quantum physics, with living things, with biology. And there's a very well-known quantum guy called Brian Josephson, who was a British fellow, who got a Nobel Prize in quantum physics, and he believes that psychic occurrences are a major demonstration of this principle of entanglement, and that the evidence for this entanglement, the empirical evidence, not the theoretical evidence, that's already strong, but the physical or empirical evidence for this quantum entanglement is much stronger in parapsychology than it is in the experiments that have been conducted to date in physics. So he, as it were, leans on the findings of parapsychology to demonstrate entanglement and then to carry this research further. But now it is biological studies that we are dealing with, because we're dealing with living beings, not dealing with inanimate objects. That's a perspective that I think is very valid, and that we have to follow, because obviously we're living beings.
It's an incredible and beautiful tapestry, it seems.
Yeah, well, it is.
And, you know, the whole interconnectedness is absolutely fascinating, and how the quantum interaction with human consciousness.
Yeah.
Do you think that we'll ever be able to differentiate how they either work together or interface, Doctor?
Well, the thing is that tell me how do heads and tails of a coin interface?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they don't. They're on different sides, but you can't have a coin without having two faces, and the same with these other things. So mind and matter are like two sides of a coin. You can look at mind, you can look at matter, you can look at body, you know, you can look at consciousness, but they're part of the same thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and as you say, also this kind of humanizes science. because this business of entanglement says that we are connected, you know, and that if we're all connected, well, then you can become aware of this connected. You can experience that connectedness.
You know, that's one of the things that we're real high on, Spirit Team, Paranexus. We're really high on understanding the human condition by our research. And isn't that essentially what you're doing, trying to understand the human condition, understand the
Yes, it certainly is. It certainly is. That's right.
And so that's why this is so amazing. And I just want to remind our listeners, too, that, again, you can call in. The number's there on your screen. And if you're in chat, you can ask a question there. We'll be happy to ask Dr. Roll that. Dr. Roll, I wanted to bring up the Olive Hill case.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting because there's some history that I share with that in a certain aspect. Now, the Olive Hill case, I forget how old she was at the time. Forgive me for that. She was a teenager, right? She was 14.
I think it was a boy. He was 12 years old. Yeah, Roger Callahan. Yeah.
I'm talking about the Olive Hill, where the family was Jehovah's Witnesses, and they had thought that you brought the demon in.
I think I think that was a boy.
Oh, it was a boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess it was old. I think his name, Bill, was Roger.
Yeah.
Yeah, Roger Callahan, and his parents were Jehovah's Witnesses. And that's correct. Yes.
Well, the reason I bring that up is because I spent 40 years as a Jehovah's Witness. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, and I left them 9 years ago, and I couldn't be happier because it held me back. And so I had to chuckle when I read that, you know, that they thought you brought a demon, and that isn't completely in line with Jehovah's Witness thinking.
Yeah.
You know,
well, in a way, it's natural that they should suspect that because... The occurrences were concentrated in the homes of the grandparents, in Mr. Callahan's father's and mother's home. And then we all met in the grandparents' home, and then we all went to the boy's own home with his mother and father.
Who were Jehovah's Witnesses, right?
Yeah.
And were the grandparents Jehovah's Witnesses?
I don't know.
Okay, that would make sense if they weren't, because otherwise I'm curious as to why they would even invite you in. But
we just sort of invited ourselves along.
Oh, okay.
And then when the occurrences started up, Mrs. Callahan, you know, the boy's mother, at that point thought, well, the only explanation is that we brought the poltergeist to their home from the grandparents' home. The grandparents, as far as she was concerned, weren't all that good, but she was good.
Right.
And so it didn't make any sense that the poltergeist should visit her, or demon should visit her. So she asked us to leave, which we had to do.
So one of the things that you have touched on in several of these stories investigations that you've done, the research that you've done, and this is obvious, but I think it's fascinating, and I think that a lot of paranormal research groups could benefit from this, is the connection between dysfunction in the home and RSPK activity.
Yes, yeah.
Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Well, the occurrences in all the cases we have studied happened in a situation where there's a great deal of tension between a younger member in the family, very often someone in their teens, and the parents or grandparents. And of course, the teens are already at a time of turmoil, change, hormonal change, and so on and so on. So it's already a time of disturbance. And then this tension, and then there may be external triggers. For instance, these occurrences start up, tend to start up at times of geomagnetic disturbances, you know, when when the magnetic field of the Earth is disturbed by sunspots and stuff like that. You know, sometimes electricity goes wrong, garages, doors open and close, electric garage doors open and close, and so on. And the brain is highly sensitive to these fields. So we have found that these perturbations tend to coincide with the onset of RSDK. So here's another sort of piece in the puzzle. Why should these things start up? So we have a psychological situation that seems to be universal. We have this geomagnetic factor that plays in several cases. And then also several other people exhibit brain anomalies to begin with, such as anomalous electromagnetic firings in the brain of the kind that can lead to make the person diagnosed as epileptic. So all these things come together create this display of moving objects. And
Bill, if I can... Oh, I'm sorry,
yeah?
Bill.
No, go ahead.
Can I interject a little something in here about the Olive Hill case? That's Roger. I was wondering, could it be possibly that Roger was rebelling against his parents' beliefs? That maybe
I don't think so. No. He was rebelling, but not against his parents. The occurrences, as I said, started up in the grandparents' home, and he had to spend a lot of time there, sort of doing chores for his grandparents, and he had to share the bedroom, and you know, he was 12 and sort of moving into adolescence. So I think there was tension indeed, as you suggest, but the tension was with the grandparents. We don't find, I don't think, sort of intellectual things like, I don't believe what they believe, you know, I think Jehovah's Witness stuff doesn't work at all. And I think it's more deeper, it's more emotional, you know.
Well, definitely the emotional, I think, with the adolescents plays a very important part, because I noticed that in a lot of your cases, as you said before, they were all adolescents, they were either age 12, 14, and then there's that one unusual case that happened, Doug, right here in Grant in Miami with a young man, I think he was 18.
With Julio.
Right.
And that was, again, out of emotions, out of stress, out of tension, and apparently he was not getting along with his boss or something of that nature, breaking things.
That's right.
Well, you know what's really interesting about that gentleman is the fact that it seems to be, it's almost an externalization of that conflict that's going on. And one of the things that I think you talk about in what I read in one of your publications, Doctor, is the fact that sometimes, or correct me if I'm wrong here, that the person who possibly is generating the phenomena is not really all that aware of it.
Entirely unaware. Entirely unaware until we get on the scene, you know, and we're hanging around this person all the time. Then he sort of adds two and two together and comes up with four, and that he must be involved, you know. But until that time, he or she is quite unconscious of playing any role in this stuff.
One question that comes to mind, Doctor, especially, you know, if we can just digress for a second about teenagers, there's a lot of research now saying that teenagers are going through these incredible changes in their brain. And I'm just wondering, has any of the research ever borne out that the actual anatomical changes in the brain somehow might induce this sort of thing to happen?
No. I mean... You know, we basically scratch the surface, and our findings are very interesting and so forth, but it really takes a lot of digging and participation of other researchers to really find out if exactly what's going on in the brain and how these brain processes correlate with the movements of objects around the person.
Mm-hmm.
And all we know now is that it makes sense in terms of the psychology of the situation, because the movements typically involve, for instance, in this in Miami case, it was the belongings of the boss that was targeted, you know, and he was, Julio was upset at the boss, so it makes sense that the things that were destroyed were the boss's possessions. But what the neurological process is, we don't know.
All right, so let's take just a second and let's see if we can apply this to some useful techniques that paranormal researchers can use when they're doing an investigation. We have come across ourselves several cases where we have suspected RSPK and have pretty good evidence of it. And so, correct me if I'm wrong, but as we go on an investigation and doing the research and trying to help the client figure out what's going on, if we've got evidence for RSPK, if there is an agent, a teenager especially, involved in it, then one of the things to look for is what exactly is going on, what's being moved, what's being targeted. Is it the possessions of a particular other person in the household? And that could give us some clues as to what might be going on, and namely RSPK. Does that make sense?
That's exactly right, yeah.
So paranormal research groups that are listening, think about that.
Yeah, okay. parapsychology we have to live with, you know. And paranormal says that these things are outside the normal, outside the natural. And it's just a word I don't like because it sort of cements our distance from science. So it's a term that I really don't like and I don't ever use. And the parapsychology we're stuck with, and that's all right, because few parapsychologists now believe that para means above or beyond, you know. Paranormal means above, beyond the normal. Of course, same is true for parapsychology, but no parapsychologist nowadays have the opinion that our science is above or beyond beside psychology. You know, it's all the same thing. And now it turns out that the basic science that makes sense of everything for us.
Okay, so what term would you use?
Well, parapsychology is all right. I use psi research. I think PSI is completely neutral, so I like that. But parapsychology is okay, too. I just don't like the word paranormal.
Okay, well, I appreciate that and respect that, and not sure I disagree.
Yeah.
The reason I'm using that is because we have a number of people listening who do this type of research, but not on perhaps on the level of parapsychologists.
Yeah, well, the term is very common.
Right.
But it just sort of tells whoever you are communicating with that, I mean, some people like the term paranormal because it's more interesting than the normal. But from my point of view, we're trying to make sense of the phenomena in terms of natural science. You know, that's why I don't like the term. But I don't have any objection against people using it.
And you know, Doug, if I could just jump in too, I think, Doctor, it kind of distances us from the fact that it may be something that's intrinsic to our very nature.
Well, exactly. You're exactly right. That's my opinion, yeah.
Well, I think that the reason that the term is used is because it's above or beyond the everyday normal. You know, the things that we everyday experience as a rule or recognize.
Well, I don't think it is, actually. I think the everyday normal is permeated by this. Volition may as a very well-known a neuropsychologist, Sir John Eccles, who believes that PK affects brain neurons.
Mm-hmm.
So when you make a decision, PK may be involved. When you move your hand, PK may be involved. So again, the whole natural world is terminated. Now the thing is, you know, that our everyday life is governed by our right brain hemisphere, and our right brain hemisphere follows a certain kind of logic.
Mm-hmm.
The
left brain is logic.
Left brain. Mm-hmm. it was the right brain hemisphere follows some different rules, but the right brain, the right hemisphere, the language of the right hemisphere is much less developed, and so it sort of it remains unconscious. And, mm-hmm. and I think one of the reasons is that it is the hemisphere that reaches further into space and time than the left hemisphere.
Right.
And so anyhow, that's the picture we have.
Yeah, and I think that stands to what, you know, is recognized. So, all right, let me rephrase it then. To those of you out there who are doing paranormal to those of you who are doing research into things that would involve RSPK, is that okay? Keep in mind these things. That's what I want to do, is I want to bring it down, not down so much, as I just want to simplify and say, look for these things that could indicate what's going on. Look for dysfunction in the home. Look for what could be causing a young person to react in these ways. And, of course, we know it's not limited to young people. It could be anybody. Is that what your research has shown, Doctor?
Yeah, but now there's a whole other area of research that's extremely interesting.
Okay, if you'll hang on to that one for just a minute. We're going to take a break in just a second, and let's get into that,
right,
because that sounds
okay.
Really interesting as well. Before we go to a quick break, I wanted to just thank everybody again for listening. We're still got another hour to go. And again, we'll take your calls. If you've got a call, you can call in. The numbers are on your screen. If you want to ask it in chat, that's fine as well. And we are talking with Dr. William Roll and a very special guest. We've also got Kevin Costa with us, our fellow Spirit Team member, along with Grant and myself, Doug. And just wanted to mention that if you haven't had a chance to look at paranexus.org, please do so. We have a new association of researchers that we are launching, top-notch, professionally done, patterned after very professional associations. We also have a conference coming up in October, and we'd love to meet you there. We've got a great lineup of speakers. It's not only going to be fun, but it's going to be very educational, and we're very discriminating on the types of topics we're going to present. Very good topics, very scientifically based topics, but also within the same genre as what we're discussing tonight that allows for the psi aspect of things. So take a look at paranexus.org. We'd love to have you as a member. We have charter memberships available right now, $5 for 6 months, and we'd like to have you come in and be a part of that. If you'll hang tough with us, we'll be back in just a minute. We're interviewing Dr. William Roll. Hang tough. We'll be back. Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy.
And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org. And we are back. This is Doug Kelly along with my co-host, Grant Rubendence. Welcome back, Grant.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And we have fellow Spirit Team member Kevin Costa with us. Kevin, thanks for being here tonight.
No problem. I'm enjoying it.
And, of course, our very special guest, Dr. William G. Roll, parapsychologist, distinguished parapsychologist, I might add. Dr. Roll, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Very glad to be here.
Yeah, very good. Kevin, you want to take it?
Bill, in the first half, you were just starting, and I know we had to get off for a little break there, but you were saying about something new and exciting that was coming about. I was wondering if you'd explain that a little bit further. We're talking about PS.
We were talking about RSPK,
right.
And you were making suggestions to the audience, which I think were all good. But there's a whole other realm of occurrences that you probably know about. And they're so-called haunts or hauntings that have a very different explanation and that are also of scientific interest. So it takes a different kind of I've approached different instruments and stuff like that to investigate these things. But
How would you do that? What's the approach for haunts?
When people have called us to help in this kind of situation, the accounts have always been highly disturbing and have involved people seeing ghosts, seeing apparitions, feeling intruded upon, feeling possessed, that dogs, particularly dogs, seem to be sensitive to this, and the dog won't go into a certain room, and so the whole sense is that they're not alone in the house, but there's some presence, and the presence seems to be evil, and they're affected by that. Well, as it turns out, in the cases at least that we have investigated, these areas, and this is not anything new, a lot of ghost groups and so forth know about this, but in these homes, on these areas, they seem to be pervaded by anomalous electromagnetic fields, and they can come from anomalous house currents, faulty wiring, and so forth, and also by anomalous geomagnetic fields. These are magnetic fields from the ground, and may be produced by flowing water, things like that. Flowing water generates electricity. Electricity generates magnetism, and magnetism. There are certain sensors in the human brain that are highly sensitive to these magnetic fields, particularly the hippocampus, that is involved in memories and remembering. And when you see an apparition, it's usually in human form, and that means that it comes from the structure of it comes from the hippocampus, and then there's another structure in the brain that's highly sensitive to such fields, and that's the amygdala, and the amygdala is associated with strong emotion, panic, and stuff like that. So you see that very strange occurrences have a natural origin. By the way, haunts can be dangerous. They can affect a person's mental and physical health. They can affect pets. So they have to be taken seriously. They're not just a matter of curiosity or even scientific curiosity, but they're also somewhat dangerous to the people who occupy these houses.
Why do you think pets are so sensitive to this?
I think everybody's sensitive, but of course, you may think that you are imagining stuff, but then when your dog goes up to an empty closet and starts barking, or refuse to go up in a room where your kids have nightmares and things, well, then you're beginning to wonder maybe there is something wrong with this house. So I think dogs, well, I don't know about cats, but anyhow, most of the stories, most of the people who tell us about these things, it's dogs that are involved and who exhibit anomalous behavior.
But wouldn't it be safe to assume, doctor, that just by virtue of the fact that their whole physiology is mammalian, that they're not immune from the effects of the electromagnetic energy, and they may be experiencing something akin to what the person is?
I think you're exactly right. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, the fascinating thing, if we could just digress for a second, when you were talking before the break, doctor, about the fact that, you know, this whole phenomenon is so much a part of what being human is. It makes me wonder if how far we've really evolved in terms of, you know, dealing. It just seems to me that perhaps it's the way we interpret the phenomena, much the same as maybe a Neanderthal interpreted lightning as, you know, the gods. And so, unfortunately, because we don't have the science and the knowledge yet, many people who aren't have the working knowledge like we do, trying to let these things, or in the easiest explanation, to manifest themselves as possibly evil, like you just said in the hauntings.
Yes, I think you're right.
So we really haven't come that far sometimes in the way, maybe, you know, and the interesting thing is it's only an interpretation.
Well, the thing is, if these phenomena, by the way, they're not restricted to psychological occurrences. They also involve physical occurrences like electromagnetic disturbances, interference with radio, TV, and so on. The thing is that the way in which we have advanced, or science has advanced, is that we have discovered physical fields with which the psychological experiences, the anomalous psychological experience, seeing ghosts and things, that we now understand why this happens. So in that respect, I think we have made some steps ahead.
Okay, so in a nutshell, people see apparitions, see ghosts. In a nutshell, why is that happening? Is it strictly limited to the electromagnetic fields and water sources and so forth?
Well, the brain is an electromagnetic organ.
Mm-hmm.
And is affected by environmental electromagnetism, and when the brain is moving through an anomalous electromagnetic field, the brain is affected. You know, so that's what.
So have there ever been an instance where you had activity such as a haunting that couldn't be explained with EMFs or? That is electromagnetic fields?
No, basically it's not a parapsychological phenomenon, because barring a few cases where there's movements of RSPK, and I think that's because of the stress of the haunt experiences, it's a natural neuropsychological / physical occurrence. There's nothing paranormal about it. But the experiences, the occurrences are very odd. And because, and then, you know, people don't look into it. They say, well, that's super. Some people say it's superstitious, so we're not going to bother with it. Other people say it's evil, we're going to stay away from it, and so on. So, but it's really of something of concern to, should be of concern to the helping professions, and of course, they don't
like
listen to us. You know, they don't listen to us, and they listen to traditional psychology, and so on. So anyhow.
Okay, let me make sure I understand then. So for situations where there's a haunt, is that are you saying that that's not part of the parapsychology?
Well, it's an area of interest, you know, like presence hypnosis. It was thought at one stage, and it may still partially be true, that hypnosis may facilitate ESP. But still, hypnosis is one thing, ESP is another. They may be related, but they're not the same. It is generally thought that a haunt is due to somebody, to a haunting entity. Haunt, and haunting comes from the same root as home. So the idea is that a spirit has remained in his or her home and is creating trouble there, you know, for visitors. But that turns out probably not to be true. But sometimes these fields can make the tradition that it's a dead person that haunts these areas. That very rarely any evidence that this person ever existed. So I have a colleague in Canada, Mike DePersing, a neuropsychologist, and he thinks that some of these traditions that a dead person is responsible is that this magnetic field has killed somebody, a guy who actually lived there. And so this guy has been killed by these bad fields. And then subsequently when people come to visit the place and they experience strange stuff, that's the explanation. If they see a photograph or painting of the previous owner, that's going to be lodged in the memory in the hippocampus, and the hippocampus is highly sensitive to the release fields, and then they're liable to see an apparition of him, a ghost of him. But I know of no cases where a person in one of these homes had an apparition that really matched a person, a previous owner, a previous occupant, unless the recipient knew how the guy was looking.
Mm-hmm.
So unless he knew how the physical characteristics of the person was known.
Okay, so do you allow for a haunting that's generated by what's commonly known as a spirit entity?
Well, I mean, we just look at the facts. I hope we just look at the facts.
Yeah.
And it would be very interesting if there were such evidence, but I've just not come across it.
So every haunting can be explained in your mind, in your perspective, in your research, can be explained with naturally occurring phenomena.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that kind of correlates with some of the work, too, of Dr. Persinger, does it not, Dr. Roll?
Yes, yeah.
Because some of his work, and I think he's with Laurentian University in Canada?
Laurentian, yes.
But forgive me for mispronouncing it. But he's done some fascinating research by applying electromagnetic fields to the brain, where he's actually stimulated parts of the brain where people have had overwhelming feelings of presence in the room, they're being watched, intense feelings of fear, and it's all been in relation to the amount of electromagnetic energy that's been directed towards part of their brains, correct?
Yeah. In fact, he reconstructed a ghost in the lab that way. There was a guy, I think his name was Don, Don Hill or something. Anyhow, he had experienced a ghost in his home and was very fearful of it. It was a very disturbing experience. And then he was a friend of Persinger's, and Persinger's brought him to his lab, and he exposed him to these magnetic fields. Mr. Hill, I think his name was, saw the same ghost and felt the same fear as he had at his home. Now that, as far as I know, is the only time a ghost has been reproduced in the lab.
Fascinating.
All right. Here's a question from the chat room, digressing back to the RSPK. The question was essentially, have you ever done a research on a case where there wasn't stress, dysfunction, things like that going on in the home where RSPK was occurring?
No, I haven't. But you have to make a distinction between these spontaneous outbursts of psychokinesis that we call, that has been called poltergeist, mm-hmm. and it will be now also use the term RSVK. you have to make a distinction between those and then movements of optics that can be produced by certain individuals.
EK.
Yes, there are certain individuals who have been able to cause movements of optics under good conditions of observation. Now, there are very, very few, but such individuals do exist or have existed. So these individuals fall into a different category. One was D.D. Holm, or Hume, but pronounced H-O-M-E, I mean spelled H-O-M-M, David Douglas Holm, and he was investigated by Sir William Crookes, a well-known physicist at the time. This was back in the 1890s. And this Mr. Holm had actually been a poltergeist boy when he was younger. He was living under stress, he was sort of being taken care of by an aunt, I think, and it was a really unhappy situation. And then poltergeist occurrences, the spontaneous case of PK started. And then later on, it developed into a situation where he could evoke these phenomena at will. And he then associated the occurrences with the doings of spirit entities, including a friend of his who died. So that was his belief framework. Now, most parapsychologists think that anyhow, this Sir William Crookes made some very thorough investigations, so this case seemed to be genuine, but it seemed to be a case of psychokinesis produced by Mr. Holm, D.D. Holm, and there seemed to be no reason to suppose that spirit entities were involved. So it's the same type of phenomenon, but in a very different setting from these poltergeist occurrences.
Okay, so the person in the chat room who asked a question about what if there is no dysfunction, it was actually this person who apparently experienced some RSPK-like type activity when there was no dysfunction in the home.
Yeah, well, that's very possible. Yes, indeed.
Just due to the changes in adolescence and so forth?
Well, all I know is that it's the cases that I've investigated. I mean, a bunch of us, if we're giving psychological tests, you know, people are going to say, well, you know, they're going to find something.
Okay.
But in the cases, not only psychological tests, but just watching the family and speaking to the family, it's pretty clear that there's a great deal of anger and tension going on between the so-called RSPK aid and other members of the family.
So there's a connection between, in other words, RSPK activity is, it manifests by strong emotion?
That seems to be a trigger, yes. But it's behavior, you know, it's just behavior that's not caused by tangible contact
mm-hmm.
with a moving object.
You know, Doctor, I have a question. In Tina's case, the one, if I recall from one of your publications, you mentioned that one of the interesting things, and I think it may have been a case of macro RSPK, was when she was taken to church, and I'm not sure the timeline here, but when she was taken to church, she wasn't even at the house.
Yes.
And when the family heard rumblings upstairs, and when they went upstairs to investigate afterwards, they found all the mattresses flipped off of the bed. Right. And what I'm kind of curious about, Doctor, is how would one explain that? Because in some of the other research I've read that you've done, you said that there seems to be a correlation between distance and the effect that the, I think you coined it, psi waves. It tends to, there's a direct relationship between distance and the impact.
Yes.
Or the effect. So how would one explain that when Tina wasn't even present and it was some distance away?
Yeah, and well, this is perhaps the most remarkable example of this kind of thing. But in many other poltergeist cases, there things are reported when the person is completely away from the home. And the thought there is that when they were in the home, they left.
So it's like residual energy that they've left there, Doctor?
Yeah, a kind of charge, you know. Mm-hmm. And then this charge remained with the object, and when the person was out of the house, it got triggered maybe by the presence of someone else. And then you had an optic movement when the person was away.
Mm-hmm. You know, in a follow-up, excuse me, Doctor, does PK, like a person like Tina, is PK something that will stay with her for the rest of her life? Does it wax and wane? I guess the question that begs to be asked, have you or any of your colleagues done longitudinal studies on some of these people that you've investigated as to how long the duration of the phenomena?
Well, no, most of the time we've just done able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years I've been continue to be in contact with Tina, and there still seem to be things going on around her when she's tense or angry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Kevin's got a question.
The Dr. Roll, I know that when I was up there in West Georgia, we were talking about psychometry and so forth and about PSI fields and the waves. And I know there was some research done about place memories to account for psychometry, and it could even explain possibly some of the hauntings and the apparitions.
Mm-hmm.
What's your theory or thoughts on that?
Well, there certainly is a similarity between memory. When we experience stuff, whatever it is, memory trees or whatever you call them, brain circuits stay with us. You know, they're part of the our neuro psychological equipment, but it also appears that things we experience stay at the place, or there's that when we experience somewhere in an area, this area, because of our entanglement with the area, because we are connected with the area, absorbs something like our memories, so that when we leave the area, these memories may then be picked up by somebody else. Again, there's a quantum physicist who, David Bohm, who talks about the implicate order and the explicate order. And he points out that memories in the brain, memories are enfolded in the brain's explicate order. And he says that from his point of view, quantum mechanical point of view, something like memory may also exist in the rocks. That's what exactly you used.
Stone tape theory?
Huh?
Stone tape theory?
What?
It's commonly referred to as the stone tape theory, like a magnetic tape?
Oh, actually, I remember that. Well, anyhow, maybe something like that. Basically, yes. In other words, that was his. You might say that's a connection between, or an analogy between ordinary memory and this, kind of stone tape memory, you might say.
So what you're saying then is that psychometry, and for those of who may not be familiar with it, it's just touching something and getting an impression, a psychic impression, or psi impression, whichever you prefer, is really something that's contained in the environment.
Yeah, because the environment is us, basically. You know, there doesn't seem to be a separation between mind and matter. They're entangled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're separate, like
two sides of the coin that you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. But basically, they're connected.
Well, let me ask you this then: in your research, what connection have you found between activity that's been going on in a particular home and the belief system of the people in that home? Has there been a connection?
I think it sometimes there is. If a person has a very strong belief, then the experiences and the phenomena may duplicate that belief.
Maybe I can expand on a little bit, give you a little bit more to work with here. Take somebody like me, okay? I really never experience psi phenomena, RSPK, haunts, anything like that. I mean, I research it, but I never personally experience it. I don't have, ghosts in the house, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, and a lot of people don't. But, of course, the people who do are the ones who attract the attention of parapsychologists. So what's the connection there? Why don't I have that activity going on, whereas somebody else might?
Well, because you probably don't live in an area that's permeated by an anomalous geomagnetic or electromagnetic field.
Okay, well, I've lived in quite a few areas, and you're just saying that maybe I just haven't happened to live in that type of an area.
Well, even if you go to a haunted house, you may not feel anything, but if you live in an area like this for a while, then I think you're liable to have some kind of experience.
Doctor, if I could just jump in here for a second. In your, I think the paper you wrote in 2007, Poltergeist, Electromagnetism, and Consciousness, you mentioned the whole idea of observer participancy. Could you kind of, I think that might fit in here. Can you kind of elaborate on that for our audience?
Well, that's basically, that's a sort of basis, a quantum mechanical basis, that there doesn't seem to be any such thing as a physical occurrence in isolation. It's always a physical occurrence that is being observed by somebody. And this is most evident in certain, clearest in certain of these quantum mechanical theories. And so that the observer contributes to or participates in the phenomena that he observes. And then we're not dealing with two different realms, but with one sort of interlinked or entangled realm. And that is what the term observer participancy, I think from Wigner, as far as I recall, applies to.
But it doesn't actually say, too, in essence, Doctor, that by virtue of the fact that that point of, from the point of view of the observer, just by the simple act of observing the phenomenon, we impart information to it and therefore change it in our perception. So if, say, someone came in into an investigation, like myself, I'll use an example, I'm a skeptic, that would therefore, just by my skeptical foundation or construct, I'm less likely to influence it in a way, the whatever I observe, in a way that's going to come back to me as something I could might interpret as I'm not paranormal, but something that may be related to psi.
Well, according to quantum physics, it's unavoidable. The world is undoubtedly, your mind, your brain affects what you observe and how you interact with things. But apparently, the basis of this science is that the observer and the observed objects are entangled, that you cannot make a sharp distinction between the two.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, Dr. Roll, the quantum mechanics is the focus of your current work, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And where do you hope to go with it? What's your objective, your goals with it? What do you hope to find?
Well, I hope, you know, I plan to describe it, tell my colleagues about it and other scientists about it, and then see what we come up with. Are they going to reject, accept? In which respects am I wrong? I'm sure I'm wrong in some respects. I was once wrong in 2006 or something. I forgot what it was.
You were wrong in 2006?
Yeah, I forgot what it was.
Do you remember the date and the time?
It was in the autumn, you know.
Got above it. That's just too funny. That's a sense of humor, too.
Dr. Roll, do you feel that your colleagues are more receptive now to the now that we're having some of these breakthroughs in quantum physics? Do you think that we might be maybe edging closer to some sort of paradigm shift?
I think we are in the process of it right now. A colleague of mine, Dean Radin, has written a book called Entangled Minds, where he leans on where he incorporates quantum physics. And as far as the other people have brought it up, but he's the only sort of experimenter who has brought it up, as far as I know, in a very sort of persuasive way. So I think it's new word in parallel psychology. I think it's the way to go. This field has been in existence since 1882, basically, when the Society of Psychic Research was established in England. And, for these more than 100 years, we really have been completely nonplussed about what brings these occurrences about. So we come up with various sort of ad hoc speculations that there must be a mind effect, but then where do we go from there? How do you stop that mind effect, and how can you increase it, and so forth? So none of that has led anywhere. The only thing that seems to be leading somewhere is this new branch, which is not that new, branch of physics called quantum mechanics or quantum physics.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. Interesting stuff. We've been talking about a lot of things. There is a follow-up question on the person who asked about growing up where there wasn't any dysfunction or emotional trauma. And they say they still live in the same house, and apparently they've checked and have found no real high EMFs. I mean, is there anything you can comment on that without actually doing an investigation?
Well, another field that may we have found to be responsible, and that is not picked up by an electromagnetometer, is an anomalous geomagnetic field. A geomagnetometer is somewhat more expensive. I think an electromagnetometer is less than $100. A geomagnetometer is about $1,000, or was then, maybe it's more now. And that is really, you really need that as well to make an adequate investigation of these things.
Dr. Roll, what does that pick up? Is it very similar? Does it also pick up electromagnetic?
No, it picks up magnetic fields from the ground. You know, for instance, if there's a stream that flows underground, that produces an electric current. And because electricity and magnetism are connected, it thereby produces a magnetic field. And because the brain is sensitive to magnetic fields, you have these curious experiences. And then in addition, you have this electromagnetic complex that can interfere with your dishwasher, TV set, various things like that. You can create floating lights. Quite a show, actually, sometimes.
I have another question, if we could. Dr. Roll, how about the I noticed on certain shows and so forth, you see quite a bit of research working on right now, especially besides EVPs, picking up voice patterns, but also another sign of some form of paranormal activity or whatever, or PSI taking place, is the thermo. I don't know, Doug, if you can help me with this, the thermo technology where you're seeing actually heat and
thermal imagers
that are, you know, how would you explain something like that when it comes to PSI in certain hauntings and investigations?
Well, I'm really not familiar with this kind of instrumentation, but I'm sure there are other instruments that would be helpful in this kind of situation. I just my experience is limited basically to these two types of equipment, electromagnetometers and geomagnetometers, and to some extent with a Geiger counter. In current investigation, I participated in that where I worked with Dean Radin, this parapsychologist who wrote this book, Entangled Minds. We investigated a haunted music hall. And he had a Geiger counter along, hooked up to a computer. And a psychic participated in this investigation. The owners had got hold of the psychic, and she was participating in that. And we went down to the basement of this music hall. Well, a very grim place. It used to be a slaughterhouse and was associated with the mafia, ABCD, and E, very sort of colorful kind of thing. Anyhow, at one point, the psychic said she saw a ghost. And Dean, the intrepid chap he is, he stuck his Geiger counter into the ghost and got a reading. So the ghost was radioactive, perhaps just, quote-unquote, a radioactive cloud. And he did that on two occasions, and both times he got a reading. So there's another piece of instrument that I'm not very familiar with. I've only used it in this case where it was basically an observer while Dean did his thing. But for people who are interested in this work, there are several kinds of instruments that I haven't used or we haven't used that may be helpful,
Let me ask you, Doc.
It takes an engineer kind of fellow to participate in this kind of
sure.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this for our listeners: if they wanted to pursue and gain more knowledge about parapsychology as a field, what would you recommend? How would they go about that? Do you have any?
Well, there's a couple of societies. One is the Parapsychological Association that holds an annual convention, and the other is the Society for Scientific Exploration that also holds an annual convention. Both of them are affiliated with journals. And the Society for Scientific Exploration has become increasingly active in parapsychology over the years. And one of the papers that you mentioned that I've written before came out in that journal. So I would look into the possibility of joining these societies and attending the conventions and receiving the journals. The Society of Scientific Exploration cast a wider net than parapsychology. They look into anything that can be explored scientifically that's at the fringe of science or not accepted by science. But their methodology, they only accept papers that follow a stringent scientific methodology. So that's a
still there? Hello? Anybody with
me? I'm here.
Ah. Dr. Rill, are you with us?
Kevin, are you with us?
No, Kevin.
I think they're all been dumped.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to click off. I'll let you click onto them.
No, that's okay, Grant. You're fine. Just hang where you're at.
Okay.
We're going to... We're getting real close to the top of the hour, so I'm just going to play a very short musical piece, and we're going to try to get Dr. Roll and Kevin right back, and we'll finish this up. So if you will hang tough with us, we'll be right back. Okay, folks, we are back with Dr. Roll. Is still with us, Dr. Roll?
Yes.
Okay, good. We're gonna finish this up. Appreciate that advice on where to go for more education on parapsychology. We've talked about a lot of different things this evening. We really appreciate your perspectives and your experience and some of the different things you've done. I will tell you, it's given me some things to think about. Probably you too, Grant, huh?
Oh, absolutely. And, I just have one question that needs to be asked, doctors. Who do you see on the cutting edge right now of the field? And do you see any young upcomers in terms of doing some of the same kind of pioneer work that you did?
Well, certainly Dean Radin, he's younger than I, but he's still, a mature person. And then there's a young guy in Arizona, Brian Williams, who has been working with me for several years. He's a very bright fellow. And then, you know, I'm sure there are other people, but...
Are they focusing on the thing about Doctor? Are they turning their attention towards the quantum explanation or the more intense investigation of the quantum aspect?
Mr. Williams is, Brian Williams is he and I are working closely together, and he's helping me find sources and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Doctor, that that the time will come when we'll be actually able to more effectively measure the phenomena?
I think that time is close at hand. Of course, I don't quite know what is meant by. I measure.
I guess you know how in empirical science we want really hard replicable data, and I've always kind of as a amateur in this field I've always kind of felt that that's to produce replicable data. So
yeah, well,
am I off the mark?
No, I think that's what the aim is. We have to have a theory that results in a hypothesis that can be tested. You know. That's the way things have to go in science, and I think the theory that makes that is most promising of that is the theory I mentioned before, basically quantum physics applied to living systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly been fascinating, Doctor. It's been a real pleasure talking to you from my end. It's certainly given me many, many things to think about. So it's been a real pleasure from my aspect.
Well, I appreciate talking to you guys. I appreciate your interest and your curiosity. And glad to have spoken to you and to your listeners.
Yes, and we've had quite a number of listeners tuning in and asking the questions that we've asked you. And we, again, really appreciate the time that you've taken to join us on our program, because we are looking for the answers. We're same as you. You know, we're looking to understand this more fully and to think fresh, to think new, to not be tied to necessarily the old superstitious ways, you know, the demon thing and all that. Yeah. We're really looking to try to understand it for what it is, whatever that means, and wherever that takes us.
Yes.
So that's what I call the true scientific method, you know, not being tied to tenure or being ridiculed by colleagues and that sort of thing. You know, at this stage in my life, I don't really care about that. I just want to know.
That's good.
So if you'll hang just tough with us just for a second, Dr. Roll, just wanted to thank our listeners also for tuning in. We unfortunately lost Kevin. We really appreciate Kevin joining us as well and helping us to connect with Dr. Roll. And Grant, always a pleasure. And again, for those of you who haven't had a chance to visit Paranexus, please do that, paranexus.org. We'd love to have you as a part of this collective to continue the research inspired by many individuals such as Dr. Roll and just see where we can go with this and the answers we can find. We look forward to meeting you there. Next week we will also be back with a program and another very interesting thing. Until then, we wish you our very best. Grant, thanks for being here again.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
And Dr. Roll, once more, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And then hang with us for just a moment. And listeners, have a great night.
It's Paranexus Universe.